Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. And this is, of course, the happiest time of the year because opening day is just days away. Yes, the great American pastime, baseball, is back. And we have a special guest this week and next to sort of get you in the mood for another opening day and another season of Major League Baseball. I, as you know, like to introduce you to people that you may not know doing very interesting jobs that you might not pay too much attention to. And one of them is Major League Umpire. What does a Major League Umpire do? What is his life like? It's a very interesting and unusual profession. And so my guest this week and next is Tim Cheetah. He is a 32-year umpiring vet. He spent 26 years in the big leagues, was involved in 13 postseasons, 3 World Series, also a couple of All-Star games to boot. So we're going to learn about a very unique facet of baseball. And I think you will appreciate not only what umpires do, but I think you're going to get a better feel for the game in general. So this week and next, my guest is Tim Cheetah, right here on Hollywood and Levine. Well, my first question, Tim, is I imagine during career day in high school, you did not say, I want to be an umpire. How does one become an umpire, or how does one decide he wants to become an umpire?
Get that question a lot. We all do. You know, nobody grows up dreaming of that, being a professional official in any sport, really, much less even at the high school and college levels. But you wind up becoming one somehow, and usually, most of us played to some level, and somewhere along the line, there was a game, whatever, where they didn't have an umpire, and somebody that's in charge, like your coach or your rec center director or something, kind of comes to you and says, I really need your help here. Well, what do you need? Well, I need you to umpire this game. Right. Yeah, I'm not going to do that. And they talk you into it somehow, some way. And for myself, I was in the seventh grade, and I had just finished my Catholic grade school baseball practice. And there was a girls' softball game across the field, and the umpire didn't show up. And this very thing happened. My coach said, I really need you to do this for me. And he's offering all kinds. He said, first of all, the Catholic Athletic Association will pay you $4.
Wow.
Well, that was 1974.
Resist that.
No. And, of course, my allowance from my parents was $5 in a week. So eventually I said, okay, I'll do it. And everyone will tell you it's a fight or flight experience. You either just run from it. For example, I've met people so many times over the years when they find out you're an umpire, they say, oh man, I had to umpire my kid's game one time, and I never ever wanted to do that for as long as I live. Because the first game you ever umpire, you pretty much know all the players and all their parents, and they know you. And you experience for the first time these people that have invited you over to their home for dinner or to sleep overnight or whatever with their kids, and they're yelling at you. And I mean, they're yelling at you. They're not saying, come on, Tim. They're yelling at you. And the job itself has, a level of competition to it, because you're actually competing with perfection. And you start to, like I said, if you run from it, you'll never look back. But some people just are attracted to it to the point where they start watching others umpire and referee when they go to games. And then you start seeing guys that, are real good high school and Division III and Division II officials in all sports. And it just becomes kind of a thing. My goal really was, once I started doing it, I would have played my varsity senior year in high school, but only because we weren't very good. I would have never played a day beyond high school. But I'd already gotten to actually umpire some high school games while I was still in high school. And I really enjoyed it. And most guys that made it to the big leagues or the tops of whatever major sport had a mentor of some kind, somebody who had experience and saw some talent in you and wanted to take you along with them and work with you and teach you and share everything that they knew. And it's a pretty tight fraternity, and everybody has that same that love for it for some reason. And again, it's the challenge that it poses for you to be good at it,
And you
because
mentioned
not.
challenge too, because I'm sure for most of us who love baseball, we first wanted to be players. We reached a point where we realized we were never going to be major league caliber players, but we still wanted to be part of the game somehow. For me, it was broadcasting, and for you, it was being an umpire. The foundation is your love of the game of baseball.
No question about it. And I refereed hockey and I officiated football as well. And when I graduated high school, I had a kind of a desire to be, I had the teacher coach bug, I wanted to teach history and English and maybe even, get myself into some sort of administrative position, athletic director, principal, those kinds of things. And then if I could ever, referee or umpire the state tournament, that would be just the greatest thing ever. Well, it turns out that I did umpire the state tournament. Only I was 20 years old when I did it. I was only halfway through college. And I don't know if they have this where you are, but here most of the private colleges are on semesters, and they have January term. Is that a term you're familiar with? Okay, so January term ex consists of about 5 weeks. And in your 4 years of college, you must take two courses in January term. You can take the other two off if you choose. And they have short courses available at the school, or you can do an internship somewhere. I chose to go to umpire school in Florida, and really for several reasons. Number one, I was getting college credit for it. Number two, I was in Florida for the month of January, which was probably the biggest thing.
Yeah, since you
And
grew up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, yeah.
middle of the snow. And thirdly, I wanted to just kind of hone my skills. And I really didn't go there with the intent of getting a job. And it turns out that I finished first in the class, and they offered me a job in the Class A California League right there on the spot. I had to call my parents and say, I'm not coming home. I'm going to Fresno, California on Friday, and I got to open up on, or I'm going Thursday. I got to open up on Friday and let's see what happens,
Wow.
and that's when it starts, and that's when you start working your way up. Here's a classic example for you, Ken, because you'll be able to identify this, and most of the listeners too, probably. My first game as a professional umpire, the managers were Terry Collins and Joe Madden, and it was their first games as well. And so I've known those guys for 40 years, amongst many, many, many others. And you come up through the minor leagues together, either umpiring them as players or as managers, coaches, farm directors. You cross paths in so many different ways over the years.
Sure.
It becomes a very friendly professional relationship. You're part of the family once you get into that. And it was, for me, it was a hobby that became a career. And when I went to umpire school, the starting salary for a major league umpire was $12,500. That was 1980. And I didn't, nobody paid any attention to the money. You just liked doing it. And of
Wait,
course,
twelve
what's happened?
thousand dollars a year for 6, 7 months, counting spring
Seven,
training.
correct,
Yeah.
7 months. Yeah. You had to
Yeah.
work in the off season. You had to work in the off season to make ends meet. And then eventually, of course, as player salaries rose, umpires rose, with that. And now, of course, a 20 year veteran umpire is making probably what the minimum player salary is now, probably a half a million dollars or better.
Oh yeah, well
Um,
that's quite
yeah.
a jump up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's go back to the minors. I spent 3 years in the minors before I
Okay.
got my big league job. I was in the International League, and before I started, I got a book called Knotty Problems,
Oh
which
boy. Yeah,
is
everybody's read that one.
a book all about different crazy plays in baseball and how the umpires ruled. And it's kind of a quiz book. And I took the quiz and I got a lot right and I got some wrong. And they explain the rationale behind their decisions. And a
Sure.
lot of it I got. And then there were like a few questions where I still didn't get. I didn't even understand the explanation. So I
Right.
get to Syracuse, which was my first job, and I decide to knock on the door of the umpires' room. And I go in and I meet the umpires, really nice guys, and I showed them the book and I showed them the problems, and they all disagreed
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's
among themselves.
called Knotty Problems for a reason, It's knotty for everybody. That's funny.
But I found that having relationships with the umpires was a great resource. Not a lot of
Well,
people came in to say hi to them, and I
right.
also found they were the best scouts ever because I remember we had interleague play with the American Association, so we
Sure.
saw these teams once or twice a year that we never saw. And normally, as a broadcaster, you would go to the pitching coach, say, and say, what's this guy like? And the pitching coach were always, this guy's great, this guy's fantastic, this guy's a Hall of Famer. And then you go and you talk to the umpires and you go, this guy throws straight as a string, this guy has no curveball. And it's
Oh,
like
yeah.
you guys were my source.
My very first major league spring training game was in Winter Haven, Florida, when that's where when the Red Sox were there, and they were playing the Tigers, who were the defending world champions. And when I got there, there was a retired umpire named Hank Sore, and Hank was from Nantucket. He was a New Englander. Now, Hank Sore played in the National Football League. He coached in the NBA, and he umpired in the American League. That's
Wow.
pretty
Yeah.
impressive, right? So for my spring, which I was working about 30, I was working almost every day. I had about 30 games, and Hank's job was me. He went to every one of my games. Well, the very first day, I got there about an hour and a half before, and Hank said, the two broadcasters, one from the Tigers and one from the Red Sox, came in, and they want to meet you because I have an unusual spelling of my last name. And those old school guys, they knew us personally. So here comes Ernie Harwell and Ned, what was Ned's last? Ned
Ned
Martin
Martin.
from, right. And so I'm meeting those guys first. So here it comes. Well, Ernie Harwell, the Hall of Famer. And then, of course, Ned. Well, then 10 minutes later, in walks Ted Williams. And Ted Williams played when Hank Soar umpired. So they knew each other very well. And he, Ted Williams, legend has it that he felt, like you said, umpires were the smartest people on the field. That you guys know who can play, who can't play, who's laying down on the manager, which guys get along, which guys don't. He says, you guys see everything every day. He said, you're like civil servants in Washington. You know what's going on. You know where the bodies are buried, and you don't get near the recognition that you should. And I found that they said that when he was managing, he used to spend a lot of time in the umpires' rooms before the game because he could avoid the media, because he had such terrible teams that the only thing that the only thing the Senators and the Rangers.
Yeah, I was going to say he was with the Washington Senators. Yeah,
right. Yeah. And then they moved to Texas, and they were not good. And so he was the only interview they could get that they really cared about getting. And he used to hide in the umpires' room. And as time passed, this was about 2 weeks later, and I came to the game. And for some reason, I got there a little bit earlier than normal on a Sunday. So I was in the room by myself. The other umpires and Hank hadn't shown up yet. And in walks Ted Williams. So I'm sitting in the room with Mr. Williams, right? And he talks to me about Minnesota and how much he used to love to go up north and walleye fish. And he and Sam Snead apparently used to be really good friends, and they used to go to northern Minnesota to fish all the time. And, you know, I mean, Ted Williams was like the John Wayne of baseball. He was a man's man. You know, he's the only person in my entire career that I ever truly felt intimidated by. When he was in the room, you know, he just said, I'm going to tell you one thing, kid. And I said, yes, sir, Mr. Williams. And he said, you just keep doing what you're doing because Hank loves you. He really, really loves you. Just keep doing things the way you're doing them. I almost started crying, you know, when he said that to me.
Sure.
I mean, you've had things in your career that you'll never, ever forget, mm-hmm. you know, conversations, situations, whatever they are. And I wasn't even on the staff yet. I was 24 years old. And, you know, this it all came together very, very quickly for me. And, you know, the next thing I know, a year later, I was working the Red Sox and Yankees on the NBC Game of the Week.
Wow.
And, it just went fast. It's
Let's back up for just a beat.
Sure.
Because when I was in the minor leagues, it was like one of the great days of my life. It's 1988, and I'm with Syracuse, and I got invited to fill in on the Toronto Blue Jays radio network.
Great.
And that
let me guess, who did you work with? Did you work with Tom Cheek?
Tom Cheek and Jerry Howard.
Both of them. Great. Uh-huh. Great.
And that day, I'll never forget my first day in the show.
Absolutely.
What was it like for you? Did you have that same experience?
Well, let me ask you first, how much lead time did you have?
A day.
A day. Well, that's a fair amount of time because I had a couple of hours. You know, I was, you know, back then there were no cell phones or emails or pagers or any of that sort of thing. And I'm sure you didn't have them either. And, you know, it was one of those things where every umpire in the minor leagues knew that I was the next guy up except me. I didn't pay attention to that. I just was worried about my next pitch, no matter if I was in, you know, Louisville or if I was in Memphis, wherever I was, I just had to call the next pitch. And I was in Buffalo, and I'd come back from lunch. What we used to do, we used to come back from lunch and always check your hotel for the red light flash. Mm-hmm. Somebody's trying to get a hold of you. Well, no red light, so I put my bathing suit on and oiled up and went out to the pool with a book. And, you know, I'm just going to kill time. And I was out there for about a half an hour. One of my partners comes walking out, and I said, hey, what's up? He says, well, you are. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, the American League's trying to get a hold of you right now. Okay. So I call. And it's now 2:30 Eastern time. And I get a hold of Dick Butler, the supervisor, and he says, "Yeah, I need you in Chicago tonight." So I had to, first of all, get the oil off my skin and pack my personal luggage, get to the ballpark and carry my own trunk because I don't have time to ship it there. And back then, this was way before 9/11, so there were flights all the time, and especially in and out of Chicago. And there were so many more airlines. So I ended up on a, I left Buffalo at 6:30 p.m. Eastern. I landed in Chicago at 6:30 p.m. Central, and the game was at 7:35. I've never been to Chicago. I don't know where anything is.
And
You know,
that's the
I
White
just,
Sox, right? That was the American League, yeah.
that's the White Sox, yes. And so I got to wait for my luggage, and I get a cab, and I said, "I need to go to Comiskey Park." And I don't realize that it's 45 minutes minimum from the airport to Comiskey. I don't know where, I don't know anything. So we're hawking, and I'm starting to look at my watch, and where the heck are we going? So finally, to make a tighten it up, I got to the park at 7:25 for a 7:35 first pitch. I had 5 minutes to get dressed, and off we go. And they put me at second base, and this is old Comiskey now. And it was fortunate because I did have the Tigers, and I had them a lot in spring training, so I knew Sparky, and Sparky knew me. And then the other upside was, Jim Leland was coaching third base for the White Sox for Tony La Russa. And Jimmy and I go back to the minor leagues because he managed in Evansville for forever. And Jim was a guy that used umpires as a resource for many, many questions about rules and all those things. He had great respect for us. And, it was really cool. He came, he brought the lineup. He asked Tony if he could bring the lineups out. And he shook my hand and he said, "I always knew you were going to make it. I always knew you were going to get the call." And it was just a matter of time. And I'm like, "No, this is surreal. This is happening so fast. I don't know where I am." So we take the field, and there's two outs in the top of the first, and Kirk Gibson tries to steal second, and he's out, and he's out. It wasn't really a close play. It wasn't a wide open play. It was somewhere in between, but he was out, and it was not disputable, really. And I called him out. It was a third out, and I start walking into center field, and I looked up and I saw that gigantic scoreboard with the lights and everything on it, and that's when the light went off for me. I went, "Holy cow, you're here. This is you. You made it." I finally had a chance to, take it all in. I was only there for one day. I went back to the minor leagues for a couple weeks, and then I got called up again for about a 3 week stint. And then back down and then back up. I ended up working about 50 to 60 games in 85. And then I got hired full time in 86.
You were
But that,
26 years old when you
I was actually
broke.
25.
25,
But
yeah. Wow. You were the youngest umpire, youngest big league umpire, right?
I was for 13 years, I was on the American League staff. There were guys that were hired younger than I, Jim Evans was 22. Larry Barnett was 22. That was back in the early 70s. And Joe West was 22 when he got hired by the National League.
And I recall that, I don't know if it's this way now, but back in the days when I was in the minors, that if you didn't move up after a certain number of years, you were out.
Correct. It's still that way. The difference today is the level of talent is much higher. So guys stick around longer because they're very good. And it used to be there was a upper tier of guys that were much better than the others. And if after say 3 years in a league, if neither league was interested in you, they released you. And that's how the attrition worked. Today it's a little bit longer because more guys get called up and down because of concussion protocol and because of replays, guys working the replay, so they need more people. I think the full-time staff is like 96, but they tend to use about 120 or so actual umpires during the course of a regular season now.
It's not a lot of
No.
people. Nope.
No,
The ball
it's not.
players are home half the season. You guys are always on the road. Do they at
Yes.
least minimize your travel that you get to go to nearby venues? You get to go from Chicago to Milwaukee to Detroit. They don't send you from Chicago to Miami to San Francisco to Philadelphia, right?
Nowadays, that rarely happens without a day off. And, once they combined the staffs, because I worked for the American League for 15 years, then they combined us with just MLB umpires working for the commissioner's office. So now, if you go to the West Coast, you can go to San Diego and just drive up to Anaheim, drive to LA, fly to San Francisco and stay there for a week and work in Oakland and then go to Seattle. And then come back, you can catch Phoenix and Denver. So the trips aren't nearly as long. You've got Houston to Dallas now. The trips aren't nearly as long as they used to be. In addition to that, every umpire gets 4 1-week breaks. They call them vacations. It's really more designed as time at home. You get every 7th week, you're off for a week and you're home. You don't have to work, you don't have to do anything.
Of course, that's new. When you
That is
broke
new. Yep.
in, was there that
There was it was 2 weeks.
courtesy?
It was 2 weeks when I broke in. But you took them 2 weeks at a time, back to back, and then you were done. Now you've got every 7th week you're off for a week. Plus you have a replay duty. So you're actually working, but you're in New York for the week. You're not on the field. They always have, I'm pretty sure it's 2 crews in New York at a time. You and I, our crew will work the first half of the day, and then another crew comes in at night because you've got 3 time zones to cover and
Oh,
that sort of
gotcha.
thing. So the actual time on the field, now I'm pretty sure this number is relatively accurate. I think guys average about 130 games a year now versus, out of 162. You're only on the field for about 130,
Right. But when you're on the
give or take.
field, you are on the field. Again,
That
ball
is correct.
players, half the time, they're sitting in the dugout with air
Right.
conditioning or heat or whatever. And you guys are out there the entire time.
That's correct. That's
Yeah.
correct.
That must, boy, double headers or games in St. Louis before they got rid of the AstroTurf surface in the summer when it's 120, on the
Oh
carpet.
yeah, Kansas City was like that. Miami before they built moved into the stadium with the roof, that was always breathless at the old Joe Robbie Stadium. I'm a big fan. I'm more of a fan of domes for places where it's hot versus cold.
Because you're
Cold,
from
you can all
Minnesota.
well, but you can always dress for cold. You can always just put on more clothing. But heat is heat. And you can have as little bit as a t-shirt on underneath your uniform and that's it, and you're still out there sweating bullets, especially if you're working the plate. You better be hydrating, and the games at that point were 3.5 hours long.
Right.
Fortunately, that's changed now in the last year, and that's for the better of everyone involved. But yeah, it was you worked for a living. But then when you were off for 5.5 months or so, you were home.
And of course, for the players, they go on the field and they want to be recognized. They want to
Right.
be cheered. For you guys, it's like, I want to stay under the radar. I don't
Yeah,
want people to
absolutely.
even know that we're there.
We have a saying about, especially in the postseason, I would always tell my crew if I was a crew chief in a playoff series, I would say, all right. Everybody, when the ball's hit, this was before we had replay. I said, when the ball's hit, I want 6 sets of eyes on that ball. I don't want to hear about somebody touching a base or an obstruction or some silly little thing away from the action. I want 6 sets of eyes on that ball because if we need to get together, we're getting together. And if you've got something that the calling umpire doesn't have, I don't want to hear about it after the game. I want to hear it right now. On the field, let's get it right. Let's try to get it right and let's stay out of the room. What's the room? The room is the press room. Let's stay out of there. We don't want to be, I don't want to have to go in there and explain something, especially if we're wrong. if we're right, I'll go in there and sit all day. But we don't, we want to try to avoid that. That's our goal, to stay out of the room.
And I'm sure there's a lot of extra pressure when you're working those postseason games because you're right, it's on national TV and you don't see the replays. You're just standing out there at second base and you're going, okay, on this bang bang call, hope I got it right.
Well, that's exactly, and that's very astute on your part because a lot of people don't understand that. And I remember in my first World Series was the Padres and Yankees in 98. And I was slated to work the plate in game five, and it only went four. The Yankees swept them. And I had first base for game four, and if I had one close play, I had 10. And it just kept raining on me over there. Dale Scott was working right field. Now, Dale and I went all through the minor leagues together. We went to umpire school together. He's one of my best friends ever. And he was in right field. And every time I had a close play and I'm turning around, walking, I'm looking at him and he's kind of going like, we're like, sooner or later, I'm going to miss one of these. And fortunately, I had a good streak. Well, late in the game, we had a close play. The Padres were leading and the Yankees started. Kevin Brown was pitching for San Diego, and the Yankees started flaring all these little cheap hits, and they got a couple of chintzy runs off of him. Of course, Kevin was kind of a hothead, and it was really getting under his skin. And eventually, he hits a ground. Paul O'Neill hits a ground ball to Jim Leyritz, the former Yankee who was playing first base for the Padres, and there's runner on third with two outs, and it's a foot race for the bag. They both slide into the base feet first. The runner, the batter runner, and the first baseman. And there I am. I had a good look at it. I liked my position. I liked my timing. I called him safe. Now Brown was over near there because he may have had to cover the base. So I've got this crowd around me. And when I called him safe, Kevin started jumping up and down and yelling at me. I tell people this all the time. What he said, I can't say on this podcast, but in any other conditions, I would have ejected him on a regular season game, even a playoff game. But if you're gonna eject a starting pitcher in a World Series game, make it be there. Make it just make it be there. Make sure that you've got all the bullets. Don't if it's marginal,
Sure.
and eventually, Bruce Bochy was managing the Padres. He came out and I just said, get him away from me. And Bruce said, I can't talk to him. He goes, I've already been out here once. If I go talk to him again, I have to take him out. I said, well, somebody get him away. Jerry Crawford was umpiring second and Jerry took him away. And now, after the dust settles, we've got about 3 innings left to play. And you can't help but have it go through your mind in that, God, I hope I got that play right. Because if I miss that play, I am on the camera the rest of the night. The camera's on me
That's
right
right.
now. I
That's
know it
right.
is.
You're the
I
lead
know it is.
story on SportsCenter.
No question. And I'm telling myself, don't pick your nose, don't look stupid, because you might be the center of attention right now. Well, fortunately, Knobloch got on to first base about an inning later. And Jose Cardinal was the first base coach for the Yankees. And we had a pitching change. So Nobby called me over and he said, Timmy, I just want you to know you got that play right. You got that play with O'Neill right. And you really made yourself and your crew look good. And it was like the weight of the world, was off my, excuse me, off my shoulders. And was like, thank God. Because we just don't want to be the story. That's all we want. It isn't about even being selfish and having to be right. It's more just that we did our job well. But it kind of bothered me that I let Brown skate a little bit, and the game ended, and the series was over, and we're in the locker room celebrating. And they usually bring a couple bottles of champagne for us as well, and we're just toasting each other. We're not spraying bottles or any of that kind of stuff. But I was kind of quiet. And Richie Garcia, longtime crew chief, one of my best mentors and best friends in the game, he was there. He was on the crew, and he was the chief. And Jerry was the senior guy from the National League. And Richie just says, "You okay?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I think I let Brown up. I think I let him off. If that was anything else, I don't know if I let us down by not running him or not. If he got the best of us on that one." And right away, Jerry looked at me, and Jerry was a no nonsense. You know, he looked right at me. He said, "Tim, I could have run him too." He goes, "We did the right thing. We did the right thing. We got the play right. We didn't take over the whole situation. We weren't the story." He said, "We were both on the right page." Then I had a glass of champagne after that. Then I started to celebrate because the weight of the world, and people don't know me, for whoever listens in on this, when a play gets called on the field, a judgment call, and it turns out to be incorrect, and it also turns out to be maybe something that they can't review and correct, nobody feels worse than the umpire. No one.
I think back a situation like that was Armando Galarraga for the Tigers,
right,
was pitching a
right.
perfect game, two outs in the ninth inning, and there was a close play at first, and
right,
I guess it was Jim Joyce was the umpire and blew the call and blew the perfect game. And I bet you Jim Joyce thinks about that today.
Jimmy Joyce and Dale Scott are two of my best friends ever in the game. We worked in the Dominican together. We got hired all about the same time. Jimmy was my number two man until he became a crew chief. We actually have the three of us and a couple of NBA guys and a couple other baseball guys. We have a Zoom call about every 3 months just to see how everybody's doing, you know, and we're talking about everything from, you know, the NBA, the NFL, the NHL, baseball, the politics, you name it. And Jimmy just, I didn't know there was a book written about that. And I didn't know there was a book. Somebody told me, I read his book, and I said, "I didn't know Jimmy wrote a book." They said, "Yeah." So I texted Jim, and he said, "Yeah." He said, "It didn't sell real well, but," he says, "I think I might have a few left." So he sends me one, and the title of the book is called Nobody's Perfect. And it starts off, Jimmy grew up in Toledo, Ohio. His parents and he were all UAW members. They worked at Jeep. And Jimmy is just a blue-collar kid from Toledo, Ohio. And when he worked in Detroit, he always commuted and stayed with his parents because they were getting older. And this, I get the book. I'm just going to give you the book starts off with Jim driving to his parents' house after that game and having to get, you know, get some sleep, turn around and come back and work the plate for a day game the next day. And that's one of the most difficult situations for any umpire, is when you have a controversy at first base in a series and you have to come back and go behind the plate the next day. That's tough. That is really, really tough. But Jimmy's reputation was so strong and so respected that, you know, everybody just accepted it. It was just a mistake. He's a great umpire. And, you know, they all, Leland never, ever hung his hat on it. Galarraga was nothing but classy about it. And that's one thing that most people didn't know up until that day, that, you know, when you're working no hitters and perfect games and stuff like that, and people always say, "What's it like being behind the plate for one of those?" And actually, the guy that's more on the hot seat is the first base umpire for that very play right there. If you got a close play at first that turns a no hitter into a one hitter, then you got it wrong, or, you know, that sort of thing. It can happen.
You start to really feel pressure when it gets into the seventh, eighth inning and you're going, "Oh Christ."
Sure. Absolutely. I don't think it's scary pressure, but you feel it. And if you don't feel it, I think you're lying. Because the first thing that we know is that, all right, nobody likes to be no hit. So every time they make contact with the ball now, they're going to run full tilt. You know, that doesn't always happen. You know, especially a guy doesn't want to risk, you know, blowing his hammy or doing whatever on a ground ball to the infield. Not in this situation. They don't want to get no hit or, you know, shut out on a perfecto. So you better be ready. You better, as soon as that ball's hit, you better assume this play is going to be a banger, and that's what you have to prepare for. And, you know, I had one one time I was behind the plate for Nolan Ryan's seventh no-hitter in Arlington, and that was a lot of fun. And he really didn't need me that night because he was just so overpowering. But about 2 years later, Kenny Rogers threw a perfect game in the new park, and I was at third base. And now we affectionately refer to third base as the rocking chair. You know, typically you don't have a lot of activity over there tonight, but if you do have something, it's crucial because it's only 90 feet from home plate. So it could be a run, it could be, you know, taking one off the board for somebody. Well, we're in the ninth inning with two outs, and Rogers has got it going. Now, Gary DeSarcina is the hitter. This is a perfect game. And I'm working third, and DeSarcina snap hooks one down the third baseline and does one of those bag bends, and you know, the ball is foul. It's not foul by much, but it's foul. I saw it really well. I had good position on the line. I didn't move to get out of the way of it. I could have called it fair and gotten away with it. That's how close it was. But umpires don't think that way. We don't think about consequences. You call what you see. So I throw my arms up. The crowd is absolutely screaming. I'm yelling foul. Nobody can hear me. Dean Palmer dives across the foul line and he fields the ball and he heaves it across the infield from his knees. And Will Clark scoops it on a snow cone. And Don Denkinger's at first and he calls him out. And I'm coming across the field. I'm in the pitcher's mound by now and I'm waving it foul. No. The ball was foul. The ball was foul. The ball was foul. Now the place goes dead silent. And I had to walk from the mound back to third base, and everybody's looking at me like, couldn't you just have called it? You know? I'm thinking, here it comes. I'm going, this guy's going to break his bat and flare one over the second baseman's head, and I'm going to be the lead story on SportsCenter tonight at third base. And fortunately, he hit a nice soft pop-up, and that was it. And the other funny part of that story was the plate umpire was a young man named Eddie Bean. And Eddie had come up and down, probably did 300 to 400 big league games in his career, but he never got hired permanently. And he was behind the plate that night. And I kind of wanted to catch him on the field before we got off to just have him, you know, take in the celebration a little bit. You don't have to be out there, but just watch this. You'll never see one of these again. Especially you won't be a part of it. Well, he's long gone. And we had a long walk from the field to our dressing room, a lot of stairs and a long way. And I finally got to the locker room, and he's already got his chest protector off and an empty bottle of beer on his table in front of him. He's got another one in his hand, and he's throwing that one down. And I said, Eddie, I was trying, where'd you go, man? I was trying to have you just, you know, take in the whole scene. He goes, the hell with that. He goes, they take it way too seriously up here. I say, no. But you know, there again, I mean, I came that close to being, you know, in the same boat as Jimmy Joyce at third base for of all places in a perfect game. So as Tom Kelly always said, you know, one of the things that makes baseball the greatest game there is that you stick around long enough and every night there's a chance that you're going to see something you've never seen before. And that's why it's the greatest game in America.
There you go. That's part one of my two-part interview with Tim Cheetah. Come back for the rest next week. Some really interesting stuff. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister Butler, also to Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. My email address, hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. That's hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. You can see my cartoons on Instagram, and you can also follow me at Hollywood and Levine. I'm hoping to get 3 million followers by the end of June. And right now, I think I'm at 1,596, so I still have a ways to go. Anyway, come back next week for part two with Tim Cheetah. Thanks so much for listening. Bye.
Hollywood and Levine.